So, this morning I was talking about the Satabodhanga, the seven enlightenment factors, and I did make a point of emphasizing one of the central parts of the Bodhangas, piti. It's right in the middle, number four. And what I wanted to talk about this afternoon is not so much theory, but the practice of the meditation and the importance of developing things like piti and sukha in the meditation, and the importance of developing happiness as a bhikkhu, as a nun, as a samanera, if you're a samanera, and the importance of showing that happiness, especially to our lay community. Because my own journey as a Buddhist, began by reading books, but then eventually when I did learn there were Buddhist temples in Europe, especially in UK, and when I did get enough faith to want to ordain as a bhikkhu, I did not know which tradition to choose. And also within the tradition, which particular type of that tradition to choose. And I know that many people might be embarrassed by this. I did go to the Sri Lankan temple in London. And quite frankly, at that time, the Sri Lankan monks looked very miserable and fierce. That was actually Dr. Sadatissa. And I thought, I don't want to ordain in a place like that. My life is miserable enough already. Quite honestly, things have changed since almost 40 years ago now. But it never really impressed me. Because in the Christian churches which I went to, they were also very miserable. In those days, if I did go to a Christian church to find out what was going on, it was freezing cold. There was no heaters. And the chairs were solid wood with no cushions on. And the sermons were really either boring or frightening, telling you all the terrible places you will go to burn and be tortured if you didn't, I don't know what, but didn't sort of be a good Christian. It was very, very scary in those days. And of course, as a young man, that really put me off. And when you went to some temples, they seemed to be a little bit happier. And I knew enough about the Dhamma, especially phrases like Nibbanang Paramang Sukhang, that Nibbana is the highest, the ultimate happiness. And also read, some suttas like the Samanyapala Sutta, that's the second, obviously, in the Digha Nikaya, where the king Ajatasattu basically asked the Buddha, what are you doing this for? What's the purpose? You are royalty. You could live a very comfortable life. Why? Do you give all that up for this ascetic life? And that's where the Buddha started to explain all the happiness of monastic life. An ever-increasing happiness. Much more happiness than a king could have. And just to go through that, it's a gradual training. I may go through that later on, but if I have time tomorrow. But you all know that once a person gains faith and inspiration, that is by itself is a source of happiness. At last you've got something you can trust in this life. There are paths, a meaning to your life. And that gives you a sense of happiness. But when you start keeping precepts, that really starts to increase your level of happiness. Maybe you might not notice that. But I certainly have, that people who keep precepts are generally far more happy than people who don't. Simply, you may not notice it, it's just like the tide rising. As the tide rises, your happiness rises. Yeah, you still have your ups and downs, the waves, But the general happiness level of one keeping precepts is far greater than those who don't. And that's why I keep my precepts. For fun. And I say that to people, what? Because most people in this world, they assume that keeping precepts and keeping rules means you don't have any fun at all. You can't do this and you can't do that. And that must be so hard. What are you doing that for? Come on, let go and enjoy life. And that's basically what King Ajata was saying to the Buddha. And the Buddha's reply is, hey, King, I'm enjoying life much more than you are. And that was very, very true. So all that keeping precepts is just keeping out of trouble, keeping out of difficulties, keeping out of dangers. Dangers. In one of my first books, I don't know if anyone's read that, but there were these two monks who went to a dana in somebody's house. And as they were waiting for the dana to be offered, they looked at one of the fish tanks in somebody's house. And one of the monks said, a good Buddhist should not keep fish in a little aquarium in their house. That is cruel. What did the fish do to be put in a prison like that? A good Buddhist should take those fish and release them in the lakes or the rivers instead of keeping them in a tank in their own house just for their own pleasure. And the other monk who was there said, you don't understand. Those fish in a tank, yes, it is true, they cannot swim to where they would like to go to. But being in this tank, they are free from so many dangers. Number one, you never see anybody dropping a fishing line with a hook in it in an aquarium in somebody's house. So number one, they're free from the danger of fishermen. Even here in Sri Lanka, supposed to be a Buddhist country, I'm sure there's many people who go out there into the lakes and the rivers going fishing. And those poor fish, you know, they see a nice juicy worm, something nice to eat for a change, and they don't know whether that worm has got a hook inside of it or not. And they've seen many of their friends take the worm and suddenly get pulled out of the lake or the river, never to be seen again. So for an ordinary fish in the wild, it must be very traumatic having lunch. Imagine you having lunch and you never know whether that's your last meal. Whether you might bite into something, you know, some nice roti in your dana, and suddenly a hook is in your mouth and you get pulled out, you don't know where, never to be seen again. That would make indigestion even more of a problem for monks, because you could never relax. So, the fish in the pond are free from the danger of fishermen. And also, they never go hungry. You know, over there in the wild, sometimes you get things to eat, sometimes you don't. But in an aquarium at somebody's house, they actually put food in, really good food. You know, every day, sometimes twice a day. So fish in a pond are free from the danger of hunger. They don't even need to go looking for their food. It actually comes to them. And it's like dana brought to your kuti rather than having to go walking on Bindabata. And some of you, I know, living in Iran, you just have to go a long way to get food. So they're free from the danger of hunger and having worked too hard for their food. Number three. In the wild, it's always very dangerous. Sometimes little fish, if they go to the wrong corners of the river at night time, they get beaten up and eaten by bigger fish. But you never see people putting two types of species of fish in the same aquarium which eat one another. So the fish in an aquarium don't have to be worried about psychotic fish trying to eat them up. I don't know how you can translate psychotic into Sinhala, but I mean like predator fish. And what else is there? Oh, yes. You know that many of you have been cold on this retreat. I see you in blankets. Now it's nice and warm today, you're comfortable, but I am hot. So fish in an aquarium, it's just like fish in the wild. Sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too cold. But the temperature in an aquarium is always kept to the very, very best, according to science, for those fish. So the fish in an aquarium are free from the dangers of heat and cold. And lastly, in the wild, sometimes a fish could get sick. And if they get sick, it was just, you know, their good fortune whether they survive or not. But if a fish gets sick in an aquarium, they got like doctors, fish doctors, and the owners will bring the fish doctors in to find out what's wrong with them. So fish in an aquarium have got free health care. So they've got many advantages, he was saying. And he said this, and the reason I say this is because these are the advantages of keeping 5 precepts, or 10 precepts. Or 227 precepts. Or 311 precepts. Yes, it does mean you're in a box. You can't swim to the places you'd like to swim. You can't do some of the things which, I'd really love to. You're in a box here. But that keeps you free from so many dangers. That is why the precepts actually give you happiness. It's true, you can't follow your defilements and do what not really do what you want, do what your kalashas want, but it does mean you are free from lots and lots of dangers, which is the reason why people get happy keeping precepts. And when I was keeping precepts as a layperson, that was the cause of my happiness. But there was something in monastic life, they thought that happiness was wrong. You're not supposed to be happy. And true story, when I decided I wanted to become a monk in Thailand, because the Thai monks in London were smiling more than anyone else, more than the Tibetans, more than the Chinese, more than the other traditions, even the Burmese, they were some of the worst, they were never smiling. So I decided that was more attractive for me. And I was a smiling young man because I was meditating, getting good meditation and also keeping my 5 precepts. And there was a man who was visiting the Thai temple and he had actually been a monk in Thailand. So I asked him some questions. Where should I go to be a monk? Who's a good teacher? And he never gave any real good advice. And I saw him later on because I found out that he had been a disciple of Ajahn Chah and disrobed. When I saw him again, I said, why did you not tell me about Ajahn Chah? And his reply was, well, I saw you. You were smiling. You looked too happy to be a monk. Therefore, I didn't think you were serious. Ha ha ha. 42 years ago now, that shows I was serious. But it was amazing that people thought that happiness was not part of the path. And if you're happy, you're not going to go and be a monk. This was in the West. And even when I first became a monk, you weren't allowed to smile when you had your photograph taken. When I had to have my photograph taken for my monk's little passport, my monk's ID in Thailand, I said, don't smile. And I didn't understand why. Because sometimes I look at that passport photo and it doesn't look like me. I'm not smiling. And for those of you who want to know why, is that for so many years, even when people's portraits were painted in Europe, you weren't allowed to smile. And the first portraits of people smiling were painted in France. And the reason was that it was in France, in Paris especially, which pioneered dentistry. The reason why famous people at that time were not allowed to smile when they had their portraits painted because their teeth were disgusting if they had any left, cracked and broken and black. So that was a tradition why you had to keep your mouth closed when you had your photograph taken. And as dentistry improved, then it was actually quite pleasant or even beautiful for a person to smile, because you could see white teeth, you know, nice teeth. And so it was only when dentistry improved that our traditions changed and people were allowed to smile in front of the cameras. It's interesting to know the cause and effect of these things. So even in my lifetime, when I was a monk, because some of the Thai monks, people like Ajahn Chah, his teeth were all red when I first went there because of chewing betel nut. But then he had them all removed and put some false teeth in so he could smile. And people started smiling much more in monastic life, especially in places like Thailand, even in Burma, and also in Sri Lanka. I've seen Sri Lankan monks long enough now. It has changed in 40 years. Now many Sri Lankan monks smile. And I ask the lay people, that's very wonderful. It makes Buddhism less frightening. And even just a few days ago, before I came here, one of my dayakas in Perth was on the retreat with me before I came. She said, very glad you're going to Sri Lanka. I wish more monks were like you. Easy to talk to and not so frightening. So please, don't be frightening, monks. So that happiness is part of that. And precepts makes you happy. And also sense restraint makes you happy. Now, we always think, if you go and look at the movie, if you just read that article, if you go and see that video on, you know, the internet, that you'll be happy. Why do we go and indulge in sensory pleasures? Because we think it's going to give us happiness. So ask yourself, does it really give you happiness? Sensory pleasures. Even fantasies, which monks do so often, nuns as well, women and men are the same. Fantasies, sexual fantasies, dreams or whatever, do they really give you happiness? And after a while, you'll find out, no. Just goes round and round and round and round with no end, with no real satisfaction. So, happiness comes from somewhere else. Sometimes for meditation, I'll probably introduce this evening in the guided meditation. Sometimes I ask my students, once they're comfortable sitting down, peaceful, to do some visualization. I did a visualization for you a few days ago, imagining you're an arahant, fully enlightened. Now, this particular time, I ask people to visualize the happiest moment of their life, so far. The time when they've been so satisfied, peaceful, happy, that experience which stands out above all others as the happiest moment in your life. And people find that it's moments of contentment, when they may have just been having a holiday somewhere, not doing anything, maybe sitting by a beach if you're a layperson, maybe on a mountain, maybe just in a temple, in a monastery somewhere, and just, even if it's not a meditation base, just sitting there in the afternoon with a cup of tea, just watching the trees grow, watching the birds fly between the branches, just perfectly content. It becomes the happiest moments in your life. And of course, in meditation, that's very, very deep happiness. But all those great happy moments which people can recall, the thing they all have in common is contentment. Just so happy to be here, not wanting anything else in the whole world. Not wanting. The job, whatever you've been doing, the journey finished, you can sit down, you can relax. You don't have to go any further. You don't have to get any more. You can relax. Content. Contentment means in the present moment. If you're thinking about what you're going to get next, where you have to go next, the next talk you have to give if you're me, then there's no possibility of contentment. You're always thinking of what you've got to do next. Real contentment brings you into this moment and is a key ingredient of any real happiness. Please excuse me, because I like to teach lay people at the back as well. In sexuality, there's never any contentment. It's always just a roller coaster going on to the next experience. You never stop. You're always moving, 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 moving. Even in trying to be famous or rich, there's never any stopping. It's always working, going on to the next million or the next billion if you're Bill Gates. There's never any contentment there. Because sometimes I just wonder, you get somebody like a Bill Gates, one of the 10 richest men in the whole world, why can't he just retire? Why can't he say, there's enough money now. I don't need to worry about my business. Just give it away and just come to Sri Lanka and become a monk. Why not? Because they always have to do something more. It's never finished. They can never find that contentment. And for those of you who organized retreats, or who are hamdros of monasteries, or who have so much busyness to do, maybe helping with the electricity and other stuff, it doesn't matter. You can still find contentment and the happiness of monastic life if you know how to let go. Now, what does that letting go actually mean? Simple story, but always something which I always keep in mind. A great source of my contentment. This was a very well-known, famous Thai monk who died many years ago, and he was called Buddhadasa. Some of what he said was really a bit off, but like every teacher, every tradition, you always choose the very useful, important parts. And those which you don't agree with, you can put aside. You don't have to destroy everything from a teacher because one part you don't agree with. And I'm sure with everything I've said over the last week, I've said so much. I'm sure there has to be. It would be really weird if there's something I've said which you didn't agree with. I'm sorry, if there's something I said and you agree with all of it. But that's not the point. The point is, it's like a buffet. You choose what is useful for you. The food which is disagreeable, you leave aside. Other people find that agreeable. So I like taking anything from any tradition. I don't want to criticize any monks. If it's some good stuff, yes, I can accept that. And this particular monk, he was building his Sima Hall in his monastery. And it got to the Was. And at the Was, you know, it was a very good tradition. Stop all the traveling, stop all the work, stay in one place. Just meditate, develop your practice, and forget about all the external stuff, you know, which we monks have to do. So the first day of the rains retreat, the Was, he sent the workers home. Come back in 3 months. And a few days later, this visitor came, and he saw that hall, and the Sima Hall, and he asked this monk, Ajahn Buddhadasa, when is your hall going to be finished? And this monk said, the hall is finished. What? Said the visitor. There's no glass in the windows. There's no roof tiles on the roof. There's cement bags everywhere. There's no doors in the opening. Are you going to leave it like this? What do you mean your hall is finished? At which this very wise monk said, sir, what's done is finished. And then he went off to meditate. That is the only way I can meditate. There's always things going on. There's always more talks to give. There's always more interviews which somebody wants to make. No, what's done is finished. Time for me to just relax and be content. I'm not going to go any further until later on. Even though there's so much to be done, not now. What's done is finished. That is how to be content. So, when you are content, when you really don't want anything, when you are in a stage of meditation, and it's not finished yet, you're not in nimittaja, you're not in jhanas, you haven't got so-one yet, let alone the higher attainments, and you think, ah, there's still much more to be done, I've got to struggle and strive and work hard, there's only a couple of days of this retreat left. I haven't got anywhere yet. No. Always remember, what's done is finished. So relax. Where you are, wherever that happens to be, in your meditation, be content. Because contentment, santuti, beautiful word of the Buddha, of the Buddhist training, santuti, this is good enough. Whatever this happens to be. It's a little bit of a skillful means. Because when I say that, I am sitting here meditating, bit tired, working too hard, bit too hot. But this is good enough. I am doing, following the instructions of the Buddha, sitting cross-legged, meditating. I'm a bhikkhu. That's enough. That's enough wonderful merit for me. So I sit here, this is good enough. I don't want anything more. And as soon as I start practicing like that, this is good enough. Meditation just soars. All by itself. This beautiful blast of piti sukha comes up. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. What is Buddha's definition of suffering in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and many other places? Suffering, dukkha, is being separated from what you want. Or being associated with what you don't want. So, how can I narrow that gap between where I am and where I want to be? There's two ways of doing that. Is striving and struggling and working hard to get to where you want to be. That is the way of the world, trying to get to where you want to be, and that is so much stress and suffering and disappointment and frustration. The other way is so simple. It's instead of trying to move where I want to be, instead of trying to move where I am to where I want to be, I move where I want to be, to where I am. Or, as this one lady came and talked to me, she said, in my life, in my career, again she used her hands, in my career, I know this is where I want to be. This is where I deserve to be. But, you know, I'm down here somewhere. And it's such a struggle trying to get to where I should be. What's your solution, Ajahn Brahm? I said, it's so obvious, so simple. Instead of trying to move yourself up to where you think you should be, move where you think you should be to down to where you are. Then you'll be happy. Now that's like monks. Always struggling to get somewhere. And that's suffering. You're separated from where you want to be. Straight from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Definition of dukkha. And solution is easy. Let go of wanting. Where you are is where you want to be. Otherwise called contentment. Now, on this contentment business, many years ago I gave a talk, The Four Ways of Letting Go, and this is from the second Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, it's now from this explanation of the cause of suffering. The craving, the danha, the wanting, and the four types of wanting, the four types of letting go of wanting. Sorry, this is the third factor of the Four Noble Truths, the cause of nirvana. Letting go of that craving, namely, chaga, patinisaga, muti, analia, the four ways of letting go. And of all the talks I've ever given, apparently that's the most popular on YouTube. Because just about 3 months ago, it beat the 1 million full downloads. So our Buddhist society was very happy with that. Only trouble was we never have any adverts or we never get any money back from it. I always thought that maybe as a monk, I should, you know, wear on my robe. These talks are sponsored by Dilmah or something. Just like they have on the cricket, apparently. Made a lot of money that way, but that's not how we make money. We're not into money sponsorship of talks. But over a million, that's a lot of people have listened to that talk. And four ways of letting go. The central one of those is the mutti. Freedom. Are you free? Are you liberated? How hard is it to be free and liberated? When you understand what it means, it's just so easy to be liberated. And the story behind this was a story which, some of you have known these stories before, but people tell me that every time I retell a story, they always get something more out of it. And they keep encouraging me. So this was the story of one of my monks in Australia, in Perth, who did a service of teaching in prisons. I used to do that, and I used to very enjoy teaching prisoners. Surprisingly, they were honest. If they didn't like the talk, they would say so straight away. If they liked it, they would say so. Because they had nothing to lose being in prison. Talking to lay people, you never know whether they like the talk or not. They always say, oh, lovely talk, even if they have to bite their lip because they don't want to offend a monk. That's bad karma. So be very careful, monks, when you give talks to lay people. The feedback you get, you don't know whether they like it or not. They always say, oh, wonderful talk, Bhante. And they don't mean it. They just, you know, don't want to offend you. They don't want to make bad karma, that's all. But in prison, they just tell you straight away if you said something stupid. And that sort of honesty I thought was really, really refreshing. So, there I couldn't go to prison anymore. I was just too busy coming to Sri Lanka and other stuff. So I gave that to another monk. He went to the prison to teach you meditation. You know the very first time I taught meditation in prison in Australia? I love telling the story because it's absolutely true. You can't make up these tales. Nearly all the prison inmates came to listen to my talk. It was not a big prison. It was about 110 prisoners in the jail, and about 98 or something came to my talk. The only ones who didn't come to my talk were those who couldn't. They were either sick or they were in solitary confinement or they had some other compelling business. Is one of the most popular talks I'd ever given. The whole prison almost was there to listen to me talk about meditation. And after explaining meditation for about 5 or 10 minutes, that's when one of the prisoners stood up in the middle of my talk, interrupted me to ask a question. Now you monks never do that, thank goodness. You let me give my whole talk and then ask the question later. But he interrupted my talk to ask a question, and he was a very big guy. And if you're in a prison, and a guy that size interrupts you, you always let him. Don't say sit down, you'll be in big trouble. You know, he became a really good friend afterwards. But anyway, he said, Ajahn Brahm, is it really true that through meditation that you can learn how to levitate and fly over walls? And then I realized why all these very stupid prisoners had come to learn meditation. They weren't trying to better their lives. All they wanted to do is learn a cool way of escaping. And so when I told them that, you know, it's really rare for a meditator to be able to levitate, and they have to meditate for year after year after year after year to do that, it's not that common at all. So the next time I taught meditation, only three prisoners turned up. That's why they wanted to go there, to learn how to levitate and fly over a wall. But anyway, so when this monk went there, they asked the monk, can you please stay a bit longer? We want to talk to you. And they found out you can offer some chocolate and cup of tea to the monk. They wanted to, you know, get to know him. And out there they asked about what life was like in a monastery in Australia for Buddhist monks. What do Buddhist monks do? Because this is in Australia, they've got no tradition of Buddhist monks. So that's when he told them, in Bodhinyana Monastery, you're supposed to get up at 4 o'clock every morning. And at that, just the very first thing he said, the prisoners were just shocked. What? 4 o'clock in the morning? Even murderers don't have to get up at that time. And then he went through what we do during the day. Just like in Aranya, they say, well, when you get up at 4 o'clock, can you watch the TV? You know, the late night movies? They say, no, we don't have TVs in forest monasteries. We meditate. Okay. Do you have a breakfast? And when I come here, traveling, I usually do eat a breakfast, but back in Bodhinyana Monastery where I live, I'd usually just have a cup of porridge, of oats, that's all. That's why I don't have it here, because I have that every day where I live. So then, oh, in prisons in Australia, you can have so many, you can have pancakes, you can have bacon and eggs, you can have sausages, you can have waffles, you can have cereals, you can have salads, you can have everything there, just your choice. Now, what do you do after your simple breakfast? Ah, then we have to work. I don't know, I think it's Sri Lanka that you don't do much physical work. Even though in the time of the Buddha, no monks would build, we work very, very hard. You do? Yeah, very good, very good. I mean, it's not just intellectual work, but even like building work, painting or stuff. But anyway, there was this one occasion when I was mixing concrete with all the other monks, even though senior monk, even though sometimes I'm very well known, I like to work as well. I enjoy it. Bit of exercise. And also, it gives a lot of uplift for all the monks if the most senior monk, the Hamdro, also works as well. The junior monks say that's really inspiring. So we're mixing concrete, and after you mix concrete, you get splattered with grey stains over your work robes and your face. So I was going back to have a shower, and as on the way to go to have a shower, a Sri Lankan lady who was visiting the monastery just came to see me. And she was obviously a very upper class Sri Lankan lady, because she had a very expensive sari on, and I don't know how much jewellery. When I say this, and this was honest, it's not putting down Sri Lankan women, but she had so many bangles on her. I heard her a long distance away, and my thought was, it was an ice cream truck had come to the monastery. Tingle, tingle, tingle. But anyway, you know, I asked, can I help you? And she said she was looking for Ajahn Brahm. And I am smart enough, quick enough thinking, that I said to her, well, if you go down to the Dharamsala, he'll probably be there in about 15 minutes. She never recognized me, because I looked a mess, dirty, splattered with concrete. And so I had a shower, changed into my robes, went to see her, discussed Dharma, And at the end of that discussion, she said, "Oh, it's a wonderful discussion. You are a very, very good monk, Ajahn Brahman, very inspiring, and your monastery is really perfect. But if you don't mind me saying one thing, I need to bring to your attention. On the way here, I saw one of your monks who was very badly dressed, who was spattered with dirt. That is not appropriate in your monastery. Can you please tell that monk to dress more more cleanly?" She never realized it was me. And being a bhikkhu, I cannot lie, so I told her, "Oh yes, madam, I will talk to him later about it." And I do talk to myself, so I'll not lie. But I have great fun sometimes and joy in monastic life. But anyway, we worked very hard. And when the prisoners heard how hard we worked, said, "Oh, in Australia you'd never get prisoners to work that hard. We'd riot. We'd go on strike. You've got nothing to lose. And what do you have for lunch?" And again, it's an indulgence here for me. I eat on a plate over in Bodhinyana Monastery. You know, many of the monks here know that. We eat out of a bowl. And it was only a few days ago. What was it? Yeah. Ice cream. The ice cream. Put it in the bowl and it melted over my spaghetti bolognese. Have you ever had spaghetti with ice cream? Don't. It's terrible. And the prisoners were disgusted. They said, even if you go in solitary confinement, you've been really bad prisoner, they give you a tray. Everything's separated. So what do you do after lunch? They say, "Can you play sport? Can you play like soccer?" I say, "No, you can't play soccer. Monks don't play sport, and there's a good reason for that. You know the reason why monks should not play soccer? It is because if we did have a Buddhist soccer team, it would have to run on Buddhist values. Number one, let go. So if the other team wanted the ball, you give it to them. Let them take it. Let go. No attachment. And kindness. If the other team couldn't score a goal, you'd score an own goal for them. You know, it's kindness, compassion, not attachment, let it go. That is why the Sri Lankan soccer team never gets to the World Cup. Too many Buddhists in it. Even I'm surprised the Sri Lankan cricket team do any good. If they're really Buddhist in there, if they go to catch the ball, they'd always drop it. You don't want to cause suffering for the poor old batsman from the other side who hit the ball. So anyway, I said, we're not competitive enough to really enjoy sports. So no, we meditate all afternoon. Oh, okay. What about, because people in the West, they don't understand what Buddhism is, especially monks and nuns. So what about dinner? Dinner? We don't have dinner as monks. That lunch is the last meal of the day. Ooh. So what do you do then in the evening? Can you play cards or game of poker for fun? I said, no, we meditate. And that's when I remember the monk telling me this. Monks are honest. And the prisoner says, "Don't you get fed up with meditating?" And he said, "Yeah, sometimes." "Do you get fed up with meditating?" "Yeah, sometimes, be honest." So they said, "Well, what time do you go to bed?" "Bed," he said, "we sleep on the floor." "I sleep on the floor over in my monastery, in my cave." I said, "Wow." And compared to life in an Australian prison, being in a monastery was really austere in comparison. And so one of the prisoners, listening to all of this and having no mindfulness, forgetting where he was, had so much compassion and sympathy for this poor monk and where he lived. The prisoner said to this monk, "That is terrible in that monastery where you live. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" And the prisoner had a point. It's much more comfortable in a prison than in a monastery in Australia. But that, once I finished laughing when he told me that, I started contemplating. Why is it so hard to get to Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth? There is a waiting list. Now, Aranda Vihara, you're on that waiting list. It's so hard, you've given up, you're going to go to Norway instead. We try our very best. Why is there a waiting list of people trying to get in to a monastery in the West, but there's a waiting list of people trying to get out of jail? It's more comfortable in jail. So I started thinking, what is the difference, the major difference between, say, a Buddhist monastery and a prison? And soon understood, a prison is a place you don't want to be. Freedom is a place you want to be. That's all the difference. So as many of my dharikas, they're in a relationship, in a marriage, which causes them a lot of difficulty. Their marriage is a prison for them. Simply because they don't want to be there. Sometimes I visit people who are sick in hospitals and they're in great pain. They say, the physical pain is not the problem. You just don't want to be here, do you? So this prison, this bed in the hospital is a prison for you. Some people, as monks, they want to disrobe. They don't want to be here. They've got no sense of freedom. And even in meditation, you have many experiences in meditation. You don't want to be here. You want to be further down the attainments. You're not happy to be with the breath. You want to be in nimittas. You've lost freedom. And it's so easy to be free in this world. Even if you're very sick. Want to be sick. Want to be here. And then you feel this wonderful sense of freedom. If you're old, want to be old, and then the age of your body is no longer a prison for you. A prison is only a place you don't want to be. Your Aranya, or your temple, wherever you are, how many of you are really happy to be there? If you are, you feel so free. But sometimes you just don't want to be in that kuti, you want to be in another one. That's the suffering. The kuti is not the suffering. The wanting is. And lastly, oh no, not lastly, your job, having to arrange all these talks, and having to just deal with all the dayakas, and having to get all the money and pay all the bills and get the water, running a retreat, can be so much suffering if you want to do something else. If you're happy to be here, it's so peaceful. Having to give Dhamma talk. How many of you want to come up here and give a Dhamma talk? Whether you want to or not, it happens. I didn't choose this. It just happened. I had another monk. I was tailgating, as they say. Just, you know, running behind another monk. He was giving all the talks. He was very good at it. And I was really happy I could meditate, no responsibility. And then he went and fell in love and got disrobed and got married. And really left me in the poo. So, but you make the most of it. So whenever I have to give a talk, even if I'm tired, even if I don't want to give a talk, sort of at the beginning, say no, I'm going to be happy to be here. And then you feel total freedom and happiness. Mutti. Freedom. Not in the prison. A prison is any place you don't want to be. Sometimes you get to delightful breath. You think, no, it's not good enough. Been meditating for years. 12 years, that's all I've got. Delightful breath. You're suffering. It's not the meditation that's causing the suffering. It's not wanting to be here. Wanting something more. That is the big cause of suffering. So please, in meditation, wherever you happen to be, at this meditation right now, Please remember, this is good enough. Be happy to be here with your simple breath going in, breath going out. No limiters, no jhanas. Be happy to be here. You are content. Happy to be here. Then you feel so free. So much joy comes out. Santuti, contentment, is a major cause of the joy, the piti sukha. And then piti sukha is there because you're content. Ooh, then you can see some nimittas. Wow. You get some really great nimittas. Straight from just being content. Wow. Now you know how to meditate. And you also know some great Dhamma, Four Noble Truths, contentment, meaning of mutti, freedom. When you do meditate, as you progress through the stages of meditation, progress rather, ingress, they come to you, you don't go searching for them, you're learning so much of things like Four Noble Truths and dependent origination. If you understand the Four Noble Truths, if you understand dependent origination, if you understand letting go, mutti, it's very easy to meditate, no problem at all. You just know how to be free. It doesn't matter where you are, what you're experiencing. What really matters in meditation is not what you're experiencing, but how you are experiencing it. Your reaction to whatever's in front of your mind in this moment. If you think it's not good enough, I am here and I need to be up there somewhere, then it's suffering. If you're down here and you think this is where I want to be, you're free. And before you know it, whew, you've got this great elevator right to the jhanas, sitting there doing nothing, just being happy to be here. And that happiness, that contentment, that causes deep ingress into the mind, into the meditation. As I said this morning, the piti causes the pasadi, the tranquility of the body and the mind. Because you're happy to be here, you don't need to do stuff. You're tranquil. The mind doesn't need to do busyness. Business is always when you need to get things done and get somewhere and get rid of stuff and solve problems. When you're content, there's no problem. You're content, happy to be here, nothing to do. No busyness. I can do that, and I'm probably one of the busiest monks in the world on the surface. All the stuff I have to do and all the commitments I have and all the temples and monasteries and fundraising I have to do. But I know how to be content. Number two on contentment and happiness. This is something which, insights which happen, which really help your meditation, which come from your daily life. I run a big monastery, in a couple of monasteries, and oh, so busy. On the weekend, you have to look after our city centre in Nola Mala. That's No Mala place. Working our city centre, working really hard, and there's always something going on. Somebody is dying, and my dayakas, they are so selfish. They die when they want to die. They have no regard for my schedule and how it's harming. That's why during the WAS, the start of the WAS season, I always make an announcement. If you really are a sincere disciple of this monastery and you want to help the Sangha, please don't die during the 3 months of WAS, because that breaks our meditation. We have to come out, do funeral services and stuff. So please, schedule your dying after the WAS. Of course you can't do that. But anyway, so Friday night, Saturday and Sunday, working really hard, doing all sorts of stuff. And Sunday evening, go back to Serpentine, to our monastery, and now you've got to work in the monastery. So it's like two jobs, as well as a few other little jobs, like somebody started Ajahn Brahm Society without my permission. Did I give my permission? I think I forgot. But anyway, I don't care. Fair enough. Another job. I call it franchising. You have McDonald's. This is like McBrahms. So anyway, there we go. So really, very busy. And I remember one day, again, a visitor coming to my Aranya. And they're saying to me, oh, your Aranya is so peaceful and tranquil. It's so beautiful and serene. It must be so wonderful living here. And I say, you must be crazy. This is my work camp. There's so much work to be done here. Just building, renovating, cleaning, maintaining, looking after all my crazy monks. Looking after, you always have some problem going on or some argument you have to solve. And then there's the lay people coming and asking for all these dhanas and all this stuff. And oh, it's just so busy in this monastery, there's no peace at all. What do you mean it's tranquil? And I caught myself saying that, and I thought, there's something wrong here. How come a visitor can come into your temple and say how tranquil it is when you, living there, are so busy? So, I changed, and I had a little practice, which I do as much as I possibly can, not just in my temple, but also everywhere else I visit, including my body and my mind, of pretending to be a visitor and not an owner. So it's usually on a Monday morning. On a Monday morning, I am not the Hamdro. I am just a visiting monk. So, if I just see that somebody has left the tools out, not my fault, it's not my problem. I'm not the abbot, I'm not the head monk. If a visitor comes and they say, I want to see Ajahn Brahms, well, I don't know where he is. And that's actually not lying too, because there is no Ajahn Brahms, so that's very true. On a deeper level, there is no Ajahn Brahms, so I don't know where he is. For many, many, many years I've been meditating trying to find him. Still haven't found any trace of him yet. And if any monk comes up, Ajahn Brahms, can you please solve this argument we're having? Say, sorry, I'm on your visitor today. And I pretend that I'm just like a visiting monk. So I don't have any duties, no responsibilities. And as soon as I pretend I'm a visitor, just like all the other visitors who come in, then I can see the monastery in which I live the same way they do. It is a beautiful, tranquil, peaceful monastery when you don't own it. My body is a peaceful, happy body when I don't own it. But as soon as I own it, I start to worry. There's an ache in my chest. Heart attack. It's a heart attack. It's going to be a heart attack. Call the ambulance now. Oh, I've got a swelling somewhere. There must be some sickness. If you own your body, if you think it belongs to you, you are far more worried about it. Just like the room in which you are staying during this retreat. You know, a couple of days' time, you're leaving. So it doesn't really matter. Well, you keep it tidy. But, you know, if the door jams or the window breaks, well, you know, it's not really your problem. You're only visiting. Soon you'll be gone. So you don't really concern yourself too much. Please regard your body the same way. I'm only visiting this body. 70, 80 years, I don't know how much longer I've got. Well, you're a visitor. I'm not really so concerned about it. Then you can relax in your body. You get sick, sickness happens. So, as Ajahn Chah used to tell me when I was very sick, don't worry about being sick, Ajahn Brahm. You'll either get better or you'll die. So, no worry, it doesn't last. So you're only visiting your body. Now, the big one. Be a visitor to the mind. A visitor to the meditation. Never ever regard it as my meditation or my mind. Don't own your meditation practice. Then I've got no responsibilities. I don't have to make progress. I don't have to get enlightened. I don't have to do anything. I'm only a visitor. Then you get enlightened pretty quick. Anatta, non-self. What do you think you own? What do you think you're doing? Trying to get attainments. Who gets attainments? No one gets attainments. There's nobody here. It's like trying to pin a medal on the sky. There's nothing to stick the pin in. Sotapanna. Where do you stick the pin on the Sotapanna medal? Can't find anywhere to... Like you get your degrees from university. People get a piece of paper, they put it in a frame, they hang it on the wall. There's no wall to hang the degree on. So, Sotapanna, where's that gone? I can't keep the certificate, there's nowhere to keep it. It's gone, vanished. When you're a visitor, not an owner, life becomes so much easier. I'm only visiting Sri Lanka. So I can say whatever I like. If I say something really bad, doesn't matter, I'm leaving in a couple of days, I'm out of the country. Doesn't matter. So, your mind, your body, please be a visitor. That makes it so easy to let go. And as a visitor, where you thought there was a problem, something to be got rid of, something to be developed, something to be understood or whatever, when you're a visitor, just like the visitors to my monastery, they didn't see the problems. They just saw the tranquility, the peace and the beauty. If you are a visitor to your mind, rather than an owner, then instead of looking at all the things which need to be fixed up, all the problems which need to be solved, and getting really frustrated, you will see all the beauty in your mind, all the peace. So tranquil when you're a visitor. Happiness just bursts from contentment. You can't be content if you're an owner. Only when you're a visitor. And then happiness just bursts. And from pity, tranquility, prasadi. From prasadi, prasadi, sukha. From sukha, samadhi. Deep stillness, jhanas. And then you're really flying and happy. And then from jhanas, seeing things as they truly are. Insight, streamlining, enlightenment. That's how the path works. So, don't own things. Your monks, your nuns, you've given up so much. But not enough. There's still more to give up. The ownership of your body and the ownership of your meditation practice. That's the talk for this afternoon.